There's been a lot of good rockets that come out of Manhattan, Kansas, that's for sure.
First and 10. Morris the block. Wide open. The rumbling Kelce taking it to the house. His second touchdown reception today.
These are pretty familiar sounds. Football has been a staple pastime for many Americans for centuries. Playing, watching, it's a beloved ritual. But at this point, we know the sport is dangerous to your health. So, what's being done to change the game? This is Central Standard. I'm Andrea Tudhope in for Gina Kaufman, and I've got a few people here with me to talk about what's changing. So first, I want to welcome Mark Lentz. He is the director of the High School Activities Association for the state of Kansas. He's with us by phone from Manhattan, Kansas. Mark, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So last year, your association approved some new rules for the game at the high school level, which are designed to limit contact. What does that look like for a full contact sport like football?
Well, basically, you know, our state, along with really every other state in the country, did put in some contact limitation plans, and we utilized several coaches around the state at many different levels of play, as well as experience as a coach throughout our state and other states. But basically what we have done is limit the amount of contact as far as physicality in practices to no more than 90 minutes total throughout a week, which is really pretty good in the fact that we feel like they can accomplish what they need to accomplish in teaching the fundamentals of the game and preparing for their games each week without taking kids all the way to the ground. So there's a lot of times where we're using USA football terminology and the fact that live action is taking an individual to the ground. But we feel like this has done a good job of taking care of our kids where they're not getting too many cumulative hits throughout a week.
So one of our reporters here at KCUR spoke to a local high school linebacker at the start of this season, and this is what he had to say about the new rules.
You're not allowed to go like 100% basically, and I just can't play football like that.
So I imagine this might be a popular sentiment, and I want to hear from our listeners too on this. Do you feel like football is changing for the better? Call us at 816-235-2888. But Mark, do the new rules fundamentally change the game?
They don't fundamentally change the game whatsoever. Basically, it just changes how you practice. It changes how you organize your practices, and I think our coaches have done a tremendous job of doing that in the fact that, you know, if you're constantly having cumulative hits, you know, 5, 6, 7 days a week, then that creates a little more of a difficulty, and everybody wants their individuals out there on a Friday night or Monday night or whatever, you know, game day happens to be for an individual. So if we can, you know, limit that amount of full contact, you can accomplish a lot, you know, just in how you organize your practices, which I believe our schools have done a tremendous job of doing so.
So these rules went into effect a year ago. What have you seen as a result?
I think we've seen fewer concussions. I think that, you know, it's going to be hard to tell over, you know, it's going to take some period of time to really find out from our schools whether or not these things work. If not, maybe we need to make some adjustments. I think they're always open to those adjustments to be made. Thing is, this is not new at any level, and the fact that the National Football League has done the same thing, you know, obviously NCAA, NAI, and junior colleges have done the same thing. You know, we're doing so at the high school level, and like I said, every state has a contact limitation plan at this time.
Have you gotten any feedback from any coaches or any players?
Yeah, you know, as far as the coaches, we have. I don't know if we've gotten any from our players in general, and the fact that our coaches do believe that they are taking care of their kids probably a little better than, you know, maybe going live every day. So they feel good about that, and I think that's the most important part is that we take care of these kids. And, you know, did it change the game? You know, I've heard, you know, different people say things like we're making the game softer. No, I think we're making the game safer. I think that's the key to it all is that we have individuals healthy, or at least the opportunity to be healthy, and we're minimizing risk the best possible ways we can.
Mark, are you a football player?
No, not anymore. Obviously, I've been working in this in the education field for a little over 30 years now, and you know, I did coach, and you know, I did play the game, you know, at the high school and the college level. But you know, the game has changed in a lot of ways, and hopefully, the game's changing for the better as well.
So, obviously, though, you're a fan of the sport.
Oh, absolutely.
What do you like about the game?
I think the game teaches you so many life lessons. Because what other, you know, all sports do that. I think all sports teach you life lessons. And football, you so happen to put, you know, 11 guys out there on the field at any one time. And all 11 have to work, you know, cohesively together to make whatever the play may, you know, be called, make it work the way it needs to work, defensively the same way. But there's all kinds of adversity that you're going to face, you know, throughout a game or throughout a day of practice or just throughout a season, just like you will in life. And I think it does prepare you, you know, for those type of situations. And the fact that if you learn how to deal with adversity, you deal how to learn with defeat, you're going to have defeat no matter what. It's going to happen. You're not going to win every play. And in reality, in life, you're not going to win every time. So it's an opportunity to learn. It's an opportunity to learn to work as a team, as a group. And if you can do those type of things, I think that's the most important aspect that you can learn from a game of football.
So the rules of the game aren't the only thing changing. Mark Lentz, if you could stick around, I want to invite our next guest into the conversation. Qiming Huang is a neuroscientist at UMKC, and he's come up with a football helmet designed to minimize the risks of head injury. Qiming, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So I'm looking right now at the prototype for this helmet. It's a regular helmet, but from the back you can see two rods that kind of look like old school bicycle pumps connecting the shoulder pads and the helmet. What does this equipment do?
It does a couple of things. First of all, this helmet is an active helmet, so that differentiates it from the conventional football helmet. And the first part of the helmet is a sensor, and the sensor we have designed has artificial intelligence capabilities. It uses machine learning to recognize a personal signature of those head movements that can potentially lead to a head injury or concussion. And then it activates a set of linkage elements to dissipate the energy before the energy has time to materialize, and therefore the wearer doesn't have a concussion or have a significant reduced risk for concussion.
Okay. Do you have a sense of how it feels in use? Like specifically on the upper body, like the shoulders, the neck, how does it feel?
Okay. We've fabricated several iterations of these prototypes in our lab. And I've put some of them on myself. It just feels like regular football equipment.
And what got you interested in designing a new helmet for football? Are you a fan of the sport?
I am. Football is, as I would call it, one of the most exciting games there is. By some analysis, a three-hour football game, if you distill all the times during which there's live action, is only like 10 to 12 minutes. Now, for anything that has only 10 to 12 minutes of the spirit, but it can keep you glued to the television set for 3 hours, it's got to be exciting.
So you're also a biologist. How did your knowledge of the structure of the upper body, the neck, and the head inform your design?
Well, the traumatic brain injury, as well as some of the head and neck spinal injury, occurs with some regular basis in football. And we approach it by looking at specifically the function and the structure of the human head and neck. So that's definitely one element that we take into consideration into the design of this helmet.
So we have a call from Kent in Kansas City. He has suffered a traumatic brain injury, and I want to hear from Kent now. Kent, how are you?
Hey, not doing too bad. How about you?
Good, good. So you I understand you suffered a traumatic brain injury yourself.
Yeah, and you know, it was it happened when I was eight, but anyway.
So how does that make you feel about a sport that causes injuries like that all the time?
Right, right. I don't really think that coaches and NFL officials or whatever are taking the issue seriously. I really look down upon any sort of activity that would encourage a brain injury. I know making it makes lots of money for the players, but you know, what good is having all this money when you're not coherent, or you know, you're not able to enjoy the benefits of it?
Right. You know? Well, Kent, thank you so much for your call. Qiming, I want to get your response to this from hearing from someone who has suffered an injury. Your helmet is designed for this sport to prevent things like that.
Well, injury is always very personal and very unfortunate. And head injury in children, for example, concussions in children are particularly devastating because concussion causes a reduction in brain metabolism, which then interferes with normal brain development. However, there are also some good sides of it from the technology point of view. That is, it is potentially easier to prevent concussions in children than in adults for the simple fact that children hit less hard. And as far as technology is concerned, it is more feasible to remove the force before injury.
So I want to talk about young players. You heard the hesitance expressed by that high school linebacker earlier on in the show about even just changing the rules. Can you imagine a similar reaction to more restrictive equipment like this helmet that you've designed?
I think you're referring to the appearance of the helmet because it does have like more stuff in the back. We of course, considered that, and in today's sports, any changes such as those in sports would have to be approved by several standing committees on athletic equipment, and safety issues are, of course, imperative. So, for example, if you introduce these extra features of the football helmet, are you going to also introduce inadvertently other means by which a football player can be injured? And I would just say this, that when face masks was first introduced, we have to change the rules of football game in order to accommodate that.
Qiming Huang from UMKC, stay with us. When Central Standard returns, we want to hear from you. Is it possible to improve the game of football? Should we keep trying or give it up? 816-235-2888. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. We've been talking about efforts to make football safer, from rule changes, limiting the frequency of contact, to innovations in helmet design. But some would say it's the mentality that poses the greatest danger. To get to this, I want to invite Mary Fry into the conversation. She's a professor in sports psychology at KU. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Andrea.
You recently published a study about the tough mentality in football. What were your findings?
We found that coaches that that created a more caring and task, what we call task-involving climate, had much better outcomes with their athletes. We did this study. It was an intervention study where one of my doctoral students stayed with a coaching staff, a college coaching staff across the season, and the staff was committed to creating just a more positive environment within their football team. And by that, I mean they really focused on emphasizing effort and improvement, making everyone feel that they play an important role, trying to foster cooperation among the team, and really sending the message that mistakes are part of learning.
So cooperation as opposed to rivalry, maybe.
Absolutely.
How does that work in a competitive contact sport like football?
Well, our study revealed really positive findings. In fact, what led this coaching staff to be interested in looking for a different approach was that they had such a low retention rate. They'd bring in a full squad of freshmen each year, and by the end of the season, many of them had dropped out, just been so turned off. They had used a more traditional approach where everything's focused on winning, and the stars of the team get the most attention. They did a lot to create rivalry, and mistakes were punished. And that approach was resulting in so many athletes dropping out, quitting.
So how did football develop this way?
It's a good question. It just seems like we have a long tradition of this mentality that football's about being really tough, and that we're only kind of soft and caring when we win at the end of a season or a great outcome. But we're finding that with coaches really building in that approach of creating this caring climate where people are treated with kindness and respect, it brings out the best in athletes, makes them want to work harder, makes them have better relationships with their teammates and their coaches, and just overall leads to better outcomes.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of those benefits. How could a shift in general mindset realistically transform the sport?
I think it could be pretty huge. We're finding across our research in different sports very consistently that athletes, when they're in this caring task-involving climate, they have more fun, they try harder, they have better relationships. We're also finding a link to health. In our studies, we're finding that people in an ego-involving climate, their bodies are cranking out, pumping out cortisol, a stress hormone, right? And that when they're in a more caring task-involving climate, that's not the case. We're finding good links to performance. In a study we've just completed with youth soccer, this relates to our discussion so far in the show, but we found that young athletes that perceive, this is middle school and high school athletes that perceived a more caring task-involving climate, they indicated that if they had concussion symptoms, they would share with the coach. And an interesting finding in the study is that these athletes know the symptoms of a concussion. So there's a lot out in the sport world now saying we just have to educate athletes so they know about concussion symptoms. Our study revealed that even middle school athletes, there's a lot out there and they have a good feel, but having that supportive coach is the key to, you know, being honest and sharing those symptoms.
Mark Lentz is still with us. Mark, I want to turn to you as a former player yourself. What does a shift in mentality serve to change that rules and equipment innovations maybe cannot?
Well, I definitely think, you know, as you can see, the rules have changed. As the game of football changed, the rules have to evolve as well. And, you know, I do serve on the National Federation Football Rules Committee. And as far as that's concerned, and we do play by National Federation rules at the high school level and our junior high level as well. Not only does the game change, but the rules have to evolve with those changes. For example, as you can see over the last few years, rules such as targeting fouls and flagrant targeting fouls and hits on defenseless players, et cetera, have been added to the game because the game's changed. And the fact that used to see football teams used to line up pretty much foot to foot. And when I say that, linemen were all kind of foot to foot with each other and everybody ran north and south. Well, today the game is spread out into, you know, many different formations. You see players, three wide receivers on one side, two on another side, and it's created a lot of open field angle hits, and therefore we had to change some of the rules to better fit those changes in the game as well. You know, something else, and listen to what others are saying right now, and, you know, the equipment probably is better, honestly, than it's always been. Is it perfect? No, because at this time there is no helmet out there designed you know, to prevent a concussion from happening. You know, we have to continue to do what we can do to, you know, stress the importance of keeping the head out of the game. And because you do not need to use your head in the game of football as far as, you know, as a tackling form. You want to keep it out and keep your athletes and minimize their risk of injury the best you possibly can.
And,
you know, something else that was just also mentioned was on concussion education, which I think is very important. I'm glad that was brought up. And the fact that one thing I will, you know, mention is that everyone in the state of Kansas, every student athlete today has to review and watch a concussion education course, as well as every coach has to do the same. So I think that's very important as we continue to evolve, that athletes understand, you know, what they're looking for, how it can be prevented, and why concussions are serious. And, you know, and the game is important and game is very popular, but again, taking care of the student athlete is still a number one priority.
And for that matter, you know, you're talking about the importance of protecting your head. You actually need your head in the game to play the strategy of the game, right?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that part, is very important.
Yeah, so how will limited contact rules bring out the more strategic aspects of the game?
I think if you can continue to limit that, you're keeping your players, you're minimizing their risk of injury. You know, obviously there isn't a certain number of cumulative hits that, you know, maybe basically cause a concussion over a period of time. I don't think anyone truly knows that answer yet. The medical profession knows so much more, obviously, than they've known over the last few years, just because technology and medicine and knowledge has changed. And it's for the better, and I think that's a good thing. And, you know, we have to just continue to keep our athletes as healthy as we possibly can. Granted, you know, any sport, you know, creates risk no matter what you're doing. Just like driving a car, there is some risk involved in driving a car. Crossing the street, there's some risk. Not minimizing injury, because any injury is one is too many. And we've got to continue to do the things that we can do to at least control, you know, some of those aspects of the game.
So your rule changes are dealing with young players, and that's we've kind of been talking about young players so far, but dare we talk about the NFL, the national level, like enforcing changes like this on that scale?
I think the NFL is doing some really good things. Obviously, you know, you're talking about some of the greatest athletes, obviously, in our country, and the fact that they are very big, they are extremely fast. I know that they, as far as during their practices, definitely have limited contact. But again, as mentioned earlier by one of the callers, you know, there's a lot of money involved in that game as well. And it is a very financial organized, you know, league in the fact that there is a lot of money. But those individuals obviously play at a very high level, and they have very little contact during a practice session. But, you know, during the games, those contacts are definitely very physical. So they're working on it, and I know that they've put a lot of money into research, and hopefully they continue to stress that importance as well.
So, Mary, I want to get your input on this. What is it going to take to enforce legitimate, effective changes in coach-player mentality on the national level?
I think we just have to keep doing a better job with coaching education. I think there's a lot of coaches out there now that maybe have missed some of this training along the way, haven't had access to it, and they should and they need it. And change has been slower coming than it should, but we have, honestly, a mountain of research showing the positive benefits of creating a more positive and supportive environment in sport.
I'm curious about the role of the fans in this.
Well, at the youth sport level, we think a lot about parents because they play such an important key role, right, in emphasizing these positive outcomes and helping kids focus on things they have control over, like their effort and improvement, and de-emphasizing the outcome, which we have less control over. So I think they play a huge role. But definitely athletes at higher levels have to be have a lot of confidence in that their coaches have their back, that their teammates do, and that we're all trying to be the best we can be in a safe way.
I want to hear from all of you on this. Is football redeemable? And Qiming, I want to ask you, in looking towards the future of the sport, you obviously have an investment in the future of the sport. You've built this new helmet designed to make the sport safer. What does the future of football look like?
That's a really interesting question. I think different people will have different answers. I think for the American public, I would imagine most of them would like to see the game go on. But the culture would definitely have to change. I watched a football game just last weekend. When a player is down, it looks like to me the whole stadium went down with the player. And everybody knows football players have this culture that they want to run hard and hit hard, and they want to deliver really, really good hits. But today, you can clearly see that although we like to see good hits, but we don't want to see anybody get hurt.
Right. Mark, what about you?
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, nobody, you know, wants to see an individual get hurt, no matter what the competitive nature of we're competing in. And that's just not just sports. So there are young people playing this game. And, you know, obviously I don't work with the college and the professional athletes at all, or even that philosophy. But I do work with the high schools and our middle schools. And we are an education-based system, and it is very important we continue to educate, we continue to teach, because that is so important. As they talk about that positive environment, it is very important, you know, taking and learning from this game, and we continue to grow the game as well as minimize the risk along with that growth. And it is a mindset, and we have to continue to work on that. And, you know, that takes time, and I think we're doing some good things. We have some great strides we're taking. But we're obviously not there yet, and we continue to work towards, you know, reaching that. We'd love to have no injuries, and, you know, is that realistic? Probably not, but I think it always needs to be a goal.
Mary.
Thank you. I agree with Qiming and Mark as well, and I think we know so much about how to set sport up where athletes have great experiences. So I think that's the big key. And when we have coaches that are abusive and negative, it just takes its toll and sets athletes up to be in harm.
All right. Well, Qiming Huang from UMKC, Mark Lentz from the KSHSAA, and Mary Fry of KU Sports Psychology, thank you so much to all of you for joining us. When Central Standard returns, we'll turn to early 20th century politics in Kansas City by exploring the life and times of Felix Payne. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Andrea Tudhope in for Gina Kaufman. When you think of Kansas City in the early 20th century, you probably think of Tom Pendergast, the Prohibition, the jazz scene, baseball. Well, there was one man who played a part in all of this. We're going to revisit that history today by jumping into the life of a man named Felix Payne. To do this, I want to introduce historian Eric Stafford. He's hosting an event at the Black Archives of Mid-America tomorrow night. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how did you first come across Felix Payne?
Well, whenever you're doing any type of research on Kansas City jazz or the Kansas City baseball scene, especially the Negro Leagues, anything around that era, his name comes up. He was a club owner. He owned three clubs. He owned the Subway Club, the Sunset Club, and the Eastside Musicians Club.
So his name popped up a lot in your own research.
Right, in my own research.
But what was it that made you want to really find out who he was?
Well, I kept seeing his name. So, and I realized that he probably had some type of connection to the Pendergast machine as well. And I was also interested in the relationship between Tom Pendergast and the Black community.
So before we get into that, I want to back up a little and ask, what first brought Felix to Kansas City?
Felix Payne came here around 1906, at the turn of the century. And it was during a time period when a lot of people came to Kansas City, because in 1868, we received the Hannibal Bridge, and it was the first bridge to cross the Missouri River. And you have immigrants coming in, pouring into the area to work in the packing houses, the grain and feed factories, and in the railroads. And blacks came as well. Felix Payne came around 1906, and he started off as a barber. And a lot of black businessmen, entrepreneurs, they started off as barbers. He cut hair right there on in the River Market area. That's where he cut hair at. And then he did a little bit of everything. He shined shoes. He threw events. He was a owner of a baseball team, the Kansas City, Kansas Giants, at one point in time.
So that's a pretty big jump. I mean, he worked his way up pretty quickly. How did he pivot from the trade of being a barber to the things he wanted to do?
Being a club owner, yeah, or what have you. Well, it's just kind of like when you're a barber, a little bit of everybody comes and sits in your chair and you talk to people. That's one way. And by doing that, you know, you meet people. Most of his clientele would have been white patrons, like a lot of black barbers. And so from that, and then being in that area, you have a little bit of everything going on. He was right down in the River Market. He ended up opening a tavern. And also, you have barbershops, taverns kind of being like the same type of location. And some people had their barbershops actually transformed as taverns, if that makes any sense. They did a little bit of everything in the tavern or in that type of setting. And so that could have been the switch as well, but just pretty much the environment and then timeliness. He was right there in the River Market. So Jim Pendergast, Tom Pendergast's older brother, had a club not too far from there as well. And then there were hundreds of clubs, nightclubs, just like around the 1880s, Kansas City was a wide open town. So you have, not only do you have taverns, but you have brothels, and you have gambling houses, you know.
So it sounds like he came at the right time.
Right, he came at the right time. And, you know, the gambling was pretty prevalent during that time period. And he became a, what they called a, some people call a policy king in Kansas City. Do you know how people play the lottery right now?
I am familiar.
Familiar,
yes.
With the lottery? Okay. And so before the lottery, there was policy numbers. So people picked a number, and then hopefully their number would, they would spin a wheel, and then hopefully that number would come up, you know, or some type of variation of it, whatever was worked out, whatever the odds were. But they played the numbers or the policy game, or it's called a numbers banker, you know. So that's what he was. And they were very prevalent throughout the country, especially in the black community. Like in Chicago, there was a guy by the name of Ed Jones. They used to call him Emperor Jones. And they operated pretty much the same way as Felix Payne did. He owned Felix Payne here in Kansas City. And he wasn't the only numbers man or policy man, but he was just the biggest one. And he had the best connection, and that was to Pendergast. Pendergast and Casimir Welch in the West Bottoms, they had a messenger service company. And so I've read where it may have been through that kind of helped Pendergast and his connection, that company or whatever. I mean, not Pendergast, but Payne. He may have used that messenger service as far as the numbers and things of that nature. So they worked hand in hand. Also, you know, if you had a gambling establishment, in order to not receive a lot of heat or a lot of attention, you needed protection. And Pendergast provided the protection for the gambling houses. And so Payne got protection from Pendergast. And as a result, Felix Payne eventually was very instrumental in black people, their allegiance switching from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party.
Talk to me about his relationship with Tom Pendergast.
Basically, he was just a connection. I don't know if there was any type of intimate connection as far as them eating over each other's homes or anything like that. But that's who provided him with the protection. And he also financed, Felix Payne had a newspaper called The American Newspaper. It was a rival to the Kansas City Call, which is still in existence today. But Pendergast, he helped finance that.
So was Pendergast interested in racial justice in his time, or was he just using Felix Payne's influence in the black community?
Basically, he was more so interested in the Democratic Party being successful. And that it would happen much easier with the black vote, okay? And so Pendergast was notorious for hiring people to vote 4 or 5 times on Election Day. I mean, so, and there were a lot of times it was black people that were used in that. But Pendergast was philanthropic in a lot of ways as well, not just black people, but all people. And that's why he was so revered, because he helped people get jobs. He fed people. Felix Payne did the same thing. He operated a lot like Pendergast, just in the black community.
Hmm. Yeah.
But he acted like most black political numbers bankers, as you would call them, or policy kings in all cities. You know, they acted in that manner. The policy is how Felix Payne made the bulk of his money. Now, he did own 3 nightclubs, but the nightclubs are more so of a front. But Felix Payne, very influential, and he owned a newspaper.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about his politics. He was very active in politics.
Right.
And as you've just mentioned, that was another arena where he found an avenue to another career, which was as a newspaper editor, right?
Right.
But I want to ask, what did he achieve as a political organizer at the time?
Well, he organized 75 black Democratic clubs throughout the state of Missouri during that time period.
That's amazing.
Right.
So how did he do that?
He was an electrifying speaker.
How do you know that? How did you come across? I mean, yeah, tell me how you know that.
That is what's written about him. I've never heard any of his speeches, but
can you imagine what he sounded like?
Right. Well, from reading, I don't, because on one hand they said that he was more of a, he was mild-mannered. But then on the other hand, they say he was an electrifying speaker.
Kansas City was still obviously pretty segregated in the early 20th century.
Right.
How did an ambitious man like Felix Payne navigate that scene? He came to Kansas City as a young black man in his 20s.
Well, then you pretty much, you stayed in your lane, you know, more so. And it was easy for him to navigate that scene because, you know, in the black community, he was looked upon as an idol. You know, people call him like the idol of 12th Street. But he was also he stepped up to the plate on behalf of his community. He was he was one of the chartering members of the Paseo YMCA. He raised money for Wheatley Provident Hospital, which was one of the only hospitals that blacks could go to and receive medical service during the era of segregation. He was also one of the top fundraisers for the construction of the Liberty Memorial.
And he also had real estate in the 18th and Vine District, correct?
Right. Yeah, he was one of the largest real estate owners of real estate in the 18th and Vine area.
Was he a front runner in the development of that area?
Yes, definitely. He definitely was. He was not the only one, but there were people like Homer Roberts, first African-American car dealer in the nation, was down on 18th and Vine. You also have white merchants who own buildings as well. Black people manage those buildings. You have the Lincoln Building, which is still standing today. The William J. Tompkins, his business partner, he actually co-edited the American newspaper with William J. Tompkins. But William J. Tompkins, he lobbied the city for bathhouses along Paseo during this time period too, because of segregation, there was blacks lived in overcrowded conditions in the 18th and Vine, 12th Street area, and so it was very, very restricted as far as where you could go, and so working with what he had, Felix Payne, I guess, would have been like, he was involved in a little bit of everything. Him and T.B. Watkins, you may have heard of Watkins Brothers Funeral Home. They're still in existence today. But T.B. Watkins as well. T.B. Watkins and Felix Payne, they gave out free dinners on a regular basis. And T.B. Watkins, he ran for alderman. You have a lot of influential preachers during this time period. You also have Roy Wilkins, who was at one point in time, he was the executive secretary for the NAACP, but he got his start here in Kansas City working for the Call newspaper, and he was actually a thorn in the side of Felix Payne.
He was working for the rival newspaper.
He was working for the rival newspaper. So they looked upon the club owners, the policy kings. They were looked upon as bad people, and a lot of people spoke out against them. A lot of preachers, people like D.A. Holmes, who was the pastor of Paseo Baptist Church. He spoke out against the Pendergast political machine. But blacks during this time period, it was easy to switch their allegiance from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party because they weren't being treated well by the Republican Party. There were a lot of lynchings that took place during that time period. And Herbert Hoover had publicly announced that he was going to start to cater to the white Dixiecrat regime. So were being abandoned. So it was easy for blacks to switch their allegiance.
So but in a way, that I mean, again, the timing
was right.
Was great. Yeah,
right. It was great for him.
So you described him as an idol for the African American community.
He was looked upon by some people as an idol. Yes.
So I mean, what? Tell me a little more, like, what did he mean to that community? I mean, it sounds like he was pivotal.
Very pivotal, because just like if someone on your job was giving you a hard time, your boss was giving you a hard time about maybe coming in late or something like that, Felix Payne could talk to him and say, hey, don't you owe me a favor? Can you ease up on this guy? So he was in a position to do favors and make people's lives a lot better. He had jobs to give out. And he was a kingmaker all the way to St. Louis. I've seen letters where people in St. Louis who were thinking to endorse candidates for political office, they were write to Felix Payne and say, hey, could we have your blessing so much? And so it kind of operated pretty much. Like I said, since he was a kingmaker, he was kind of like a king. So, yeah, he was very. And then, you know, what is so something else that was impactful? The people that he had working for him, he had a guy by the name of Big Joe Turner, who sang "Shake, Rattle, and Roll." Pete Johnson, who's like king of the boogie woogie type piano, that type of style. Those people worked for him. And Big Joe Turner, he actually went to New York to record. And I think, as I mentioned, he sang Shake, Rattle, and Roll. And so everybody's heard of that song. But he also, Big Joe Turner, he sung about a club owner by the name of Piney Brown, who was a manager. He managed Felix Payne's nightclub. And he talks, the song is called Piney Brown's Blues. And it talks about him standing on the corner of 12th and Vine. He shook hands with Piney Brown. Originally, the original song is 12th and Vine, but then it was later turned into 18th and Vine. Shook hands with Piney Brown, couldn't keep from crying, because, you know, club owners back then were revered as well because they provided the platform for the for the musicians and the gangsters to come, you know, to come together.
So another arena that we sort of touched on earlier is baseball. He owned the Kansas City, Kansas Giants.
Right. And so that was before the Monarchs, okay? So, but he was also instrumental in the, with the Negro National Leagues was started here in Kansas City at the Paseo YMCA in 1920. And Felix Payne, I forgot exactly, but he did have a hand in that, where he may have hosted some owners at his home or something like that.
In any case, he did have a hand in many pots, right?
In many pots, definitely.
So how did he impact the course of Kansas City history and identity?
Well, he just provided the scene for jazz to develop because he owned the nightclub. And the jam sessions, things like that, all that happened in his place, like the Subway Club. As a policy king, I mean, people, their hopes rest on them hitting a number, especially during the time of the Great Depression. You know, that was a viable way that people looked upon to put food on the table. Scary as it is, but people depended on the numbers gain. They depended upon their number being hit. And for a lot of people, that was their hope. One day my number's going to hit. You know, so that in itself, like it or not, it instilled a sense of hope in people. It may definitely have been an illusion. Everybody doesn't hit. And that was the problem. But it gave people something to believe in.
So, Eric, do you get the sense that people are aware of Felix Payne and his role in our city's history?
No, not really, because it's not like he was a club owner. He was a racketeer. I mean, gambling was illegal, but still he used it as a means to provide for the community. I mean, he did a lot of philanthropic things, but it's one of those things that people are very much, when they hear about it, it's like, wow, he did all these things. I can't believe he did all these things. But I think as time goes on, people, as we begin to have discussions about this and about our history here in Kansas City, I think people will become more interested. I do.
So I imagine you've spent a lot of time delving into his history, at least over the last few weeks, maybe preparing right. for this event. I like imagining the two of you kicking back, like drinking some bootleg liquor, maybe having a couple cigars. But right. I mean, what's that been like, kind of really delving into his life and his time?
Really, it's not a lot written about Felix Payne. You know, you just have to look at the climate, basically, in what was going on around him during that time period. You know, he was born in 1884 in Marshall, Missouri. If you look at him, he looks mixed. So he's mulatto. And slavery was very prevalent in Saline County. And he came here because there was more opportunities here in Kansas City. And you know, he was able to utilize his voice and have an impact. And I think, I don't know if he started off wanting to do that, but then again, you know, some things just kind of play out that way. But sometimes you have to react according to your environment. And, you know, black people during that time period, they were really active in improving their quality of life. So, you know, they took education a lot more serious. They took having a right to vote still even a lot more serious, because things in a lot of ways, things are kind of mimicking what went on then is going on now. When you look at the police brutality that's inflicted upon African-Americans during that time period, there were a lot of lynchings going on as well. And so that also caused him to. And a lot of blacks at that time to switch their allegiance to the Democratic Party, excuse me. So it makes me wonder, it's like, wow, history in a different sense is repeating itself, and it always does.
That was Eric Stafford, a historical tour guide with the Kansas City Touring Company. He's giving a talk tomorrow night about the life of Felix Payne at the Black Archives of Mid-America. And that's our show for today. You can hear it again later this afternoon, or any of our other shows, by visiting us online at kcur.org/centralstandard. In the meantime, connect with us on Twitter. We're at @KCURCST. Tomorrow, Gina Kaufman's back, and we'll be going viral. Well, that's what we're talking about anyway. Intrigued? Tune in tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, and me, with Fridays by Jen Chen. Raven Brooks is our intern. Thanks for sharing your time with us this morning. I'm Andrea Tudhope, in for Gina Kaufman. Up to date is next. Don't go away.